Welcome to the Why and the What Product Management Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Kahn, and today our guest is Lewis C. Lin. Lewis was Microsoft's Director of Product Management. Prior to Microsoft, he worked at Google, leading new AdWords product launches. He's the author of a number of product management books and is best known as the author of Decode and Conquer: Answers to Product Management Interviews. Lewis has just come out with a new book, Be the Greatest Product Manager Ever. This latest book is not about writing user stories and speaking with customers, but instead focuses on what you can do to advance your career once you have a product role. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Lewis. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat today. Why don't you tell me just a little bit about your background and how you came to be in product management originally, and just a little bit of your story coming up in the product management world.
Thank you so much for having me. Let's see. All in all, I've spent about 10, 15 years in the tech industry, places like Google and Microsoft. The biggest chunk was in product management. I also spent some time in product marketing. And I left corporate in 2011. When I left, I was the director of product management for Microsoft's Bing search engine. I had a team of 8 direct reports, and we were responsible for figuring out, when you type in the keywords "buy flower," what kind of ads to show to Bing users across the world. Since 2011, last 8 years, I'm a full-time entrepreneur, and you probably know other entrepreneurs, Daniel, and I'm no different in the sense that I get myself involved in a lot of different projects. But the hat that I'm wearing these days is as an author. I recently authored a brand new book called Be the Greatest Product Manager Ever, and it's really about helping folks move up in the product manager career ladder. And so I've got a 6-step process where I talk about that.
So I think one of the things that we'll get into as we dig into your book in a little bit more specifics is it kind of deals with the journey of a product manager. What would you describe are the various roles that someone in the product space can work through, from going from junior up into where you feel like they are in the more senior developed parts of their careers?
Yeah, so I've got a 5-step model in my head. The first step is that individual contributor role. And you could be a fresh college graduate joining on as an associate product manager at a Google or Facebook, et cetera. Or you could be a veteran who might have a couple years under the belt, but also starting out as an individual contributor, maybe at a product manager or senior product manager level. So that first level is really about being an IC, and your standard definition of product management, where as an individual contributor, understanding customer needs, building requirements or user stories, if you will, prioritizing that user backlog, working with the engineers to remove roadblocks, to give input on designs, possibly sometimes technical architecture, helping them get the resources they need, whether it's budget or headcount or maybe access to certain data or APIs, and then eventually launching the product and working with a fairly large virtual team consisting of folks outside of the product development team, like marketing and sales and legal, et cetera. From there, the next level that I have in my head is being that frontline manager. And it's really about that being either the title might be like a group product manager is a super common one. Some people or some companies might just call it senior product manager, product manager management, or director of product management. And at that point, it's really about having a smaller team, usually like 3 directs reports plus or minus, and still having the same set of product management responsibilities. But of course, the new responsibility is managing and mentoring the team. So all the usual hiring, firing, doing performance reviews, coaching, et cetera. And then the third level to me is being the manager of managers. And so having a set of directs who are frontline managers, and below them having several directs. And at that point, it's usually a title like the director of product management. And one of the big challenges is how do you influence through people, because now you no longer work with the frontline ICs anymore. And we often see directors influence kind of the frontline work, either through working on strategy or sometimes budget in terms of allocation of headcount. From there, there's really two more levels to go. VP of product management is next. And at that point, these are individuals who have fairly large product management organizations. And so you might see this at like a medium-sized company with like 500 employees and up, where they might have a sizable PM organization of maybe at least 20 people, in some cases, maybe like 100 or 200 or 300, like a bigger company like a Google, for example. And at that point, the work is a little bit different. It's no longer about like, can you get things done? But it might be more about, can you shape your product management organization? And the quickest way to shape that product management organization is to recruit for your organization. And so a lot of CEOs are super excited to hire VPs of product, primarily for their ability to recruit and replenish PM organizations with talented folks. And the way that a lot of VPs of product do that is really tapping into their network and their Rolodex. Hopefully, they've got a strong network of talented directors of product management that they can bring over, who in turn can hire amazing PM ICs to come over to the new organization as well. I also see VPs of product attempt to shape the PM culture. Sometimes they might shape the culture to be a little bit more customer focused, or they might shape the culture to be more experimental and A/B test focused. And so some of the better ones can shape the organization to adopt new behaviors that are necessary for success. And then the last category can sometimes be controversial, but I believe that the last category is really around being the CEO of a tech company. And the reason that I say it's controversial is I know some people don't like thinking about PMs as mini CEOs of an organization, primarily because they feel uncomfortable that when it comes to leadership, it really should be servant leadership and helping out all these sister organizations. But I take a slightly stronger view in the sense that when I think about some of the most talented tech leaders in the industry, and they go by the names of like Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, and even folks like Sundar over at Google, Google CEO, some of them have had the product manager title, like Sundar, where he graduated from Wharton and was a frontline product manager and became a PM director and a VP of product, and now the CEO of Google. And then some other folks may never have had a formal PM title, but I believe all four of those individuals, when I think about their day-to-day role, they've played a strong leadership role in terms of shaping product development. And in my mind, when you're shaping product development, when you're leading product development, you are a product manager. And so at the very top of the rung, I find that the best PMs eventually become CEOs of tech companies.
I think that's a aspirational place to end up, and nice way to orient yourself if that is where someone's hoping to go. You mentioned the esteem method, which looking at your book seems pretty foundational to what it is you're writing about there. Could you walk us through what the esteem method contains?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give some context, this book, I believe, is, I lost track, maybe the eighth book that I've written. And so before that, I've written several books. And a lot of them revolve around interview preparation for PM roles. And the reason I wrote this current book, Be the Greatest Product Manager, is because some of my readers from my previous book said, Lewis, thanks for all the help with the interview advice. I'm now a product manager at Google. How do I move from frontline individual contributor up through the organization? And then this particular reader just couldn't figure out how to make their way up the career ladder. And I had several individuals who approached me. It's like, yeah, how do I move up now that I've got my dream job at Google or Facebook? And I just thought to myself, maybe I should write a book about it. And so this is how it came about. And so because the readers are looking for prescriptive advice on how to move up, I came up with this six-step framework, basically six competencies or skills that one would need to master as they move up that PM career ladder. So the first step, the E in esteem, stands for execution, and it's pretty darn self-explanatory. It's just, hey, as a PM, can you get things done, right? If your boss or your CEO says, hey, we want to deliver on this product, can you deliver? Can you make the trends run on time? And so that's step one. If you can't deliver, you can't ship products, then you're probably not going to make your way past the icy front lines of product management. The next level, the S in esteem, stands for superior communication skills. And so what I've observed is more often than not, the folks who seem to get promoted fastest to frontline manager as NPM is usually the one that's got some really great communication skills, the ability to influence others effectively, both in verbal format and in written format, can tell stories that tug on people's heartstrings, can tell stories using data. And I think there's good reason why, communication skills are so important, because, if you're playing the role of a PM, you're the hub of the product development organization, you need to influence others, you need to collaborate with others, and you can't do either one of those effectively without strong communication skills. I think the other reason why communication skills are so important is when you think about CEOs in general, they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and there's some good ones and there's some bad ones, but even the bad ones seem to have very strong communication skills. Like they're able to speak with investors on Wall Street, and they're able to speak with customers, and they're able to speak with engineers or the sales teams and other internal audiences. And I think that resonates with people when they want to promote product managers. They want to promote those that have communication skills that remind them of amazing CEOs like Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos, et cetera. The next couple of pieces to the esteem framework, the third one is stands for the T in esteem, which is tactical awareness. And I borrowed this term from the world of soccer, and it's really about the product manager's awareness of the situation, of others, and themselves. With this awareness, being able to do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. And you might have observed this, Daniel, or you might do this yourself, where sometimes some PMs look at some of the more senior folks and say, wow, how are they able to influence the VP of engineering in just a matter of 10 minutes where it took everyone else like 6 months? Right? What was that secret sauce, that secret magic, that secret mojo that PM director had that nobody else could seem to crack and influence the VP of engineering the right way? And that's what I mean by tactical awareness. It's almost that black magic the better folks have in terms of just being super efficient, super effective at their job. The next one is the first E is extraordinary, mental toughness, and that's just all about grit. And the best examples I can think of right now are just Amazon. Like, think about that poor PM who Jeff Bezos tapped and said, hey, this whole Amazon Prime shipping thing, 2-day shipping, make it work. You know, it's a must have been a daunting task to think about, you know, the objective 2-day shipping when back then I think they were shipping at like a 5 to 8 day time frame. You know, the infrastructure, all the fulfillment centers and distribution centers that they needed to acquire, the relationships they needed to have with both air delivery and ground delivery. You know, whoever pulled that off, I don't know what their name was, but it required a lot of grit, a lot of fortitude, a lot of mental toughness. And that's what we see the PMs at that level operating, where they could take these really big game-changing initiatives. Similar with Sundar. I mean, he gets the most credit at Google for willing Google Chrome into reality, or willing the Google Chrome books into reality. And those are the kind of special people that have that kind of grit, who doesn't stop and say, hey, Google Chrome, I'm not so sure about this, you know, because Firefox is doing pretty well and Internet Explorer is doing pretty well and Netscape's hanging around. Like, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this because, you know, it doesn't make any business sense and it's really hard. But no, you've got people like Sundar who just says, hey, you know what? If this is what needs to be done for good strategic reason, I'm going to make it happen. You know, and so that's what we mean there. And then the last two pieces, the other E stands for, exceptional team builder. I think I mentioned it briefly, that the better VPs of product really know how to staff up their teams, and in certain cases also teach their teams. And I feel like sometimes executives, when they get out to that really high levels, they would say, oh, you know what, I'm a little too high level. I don't need to teach my team the basics of, A/B test experimentation and interpreting results, or I don't need to teach them how to prioritize effectively. I don't need to teach them how to influence engineers because, you know, that's just not my job anymore. But I think the better ones, you know, take on that responsibility of mentoring and coaching, and I'm not afraid to get into those kind of details. And then the last part of esteem is the M for moonshot vision. And I think that's a term that we're all familiar with. It's really about the idea that the best CEOs, and there's a lot of good ones, but the best do have a vision that's as audacious as John F. Kennedy's proclamation back in the 1960s that he wanted the U.S. to send somebody to the moon. And you've got people like an Elon Musk who says, hey, I want to build a space rocket that'll take people to Mars and, come back so that it's a reusable rocket. We've got folks like Jeff Bezos who says, hey, you know, 2-day shipping is great, but eventually I want 1-hour shipping. That's what I mean by moonshot vision.
So you mentioned that the T was about tactical awareness, thinking of this as a bit of the black magic of understanding the situation to actually be able to cut through the noise and have influence. What would you say are the main pieces to that somebody could be thinking about to ensure that they are starting to develop their skills in that direction? What should somebody be paying attention to?
In terms of paying attention to, or how do you learn it, or how do you start reverse engineer it? The most important thing I can think of is the ability to ask questions. And so, well, before you ask the questions, first observe, right? So have that awareness. And so if you do see an exceptional PM or an exceptional PM director do something that you're like, wow, like how did they convince somebody in 10 minutes, or how were they able to get their way when nobody else could, observe it, be aware of it, step one. And then step two, don't be afraid to ask the question like, hey, I noticed that you did something really special in that meeting. You were able to get the VP of engineering to agree in like 10 minutes. How did you do that? Can you break it down for me? What is the process that goes through your head when you're thinking about influencing the VP of engineering? Like when they had some resistance, you know, what were you thinking next? And so, you know, getting that process of you know, asking others about how they do their job is a really critical question. And just to linger on it a little bit, you know, when I think about questions, I feel like there's some people they feel like they shouldn't ask any questions because it'll make them look dumb. And you know, clearly I disagree with that. Questions are fantastic. It's a beautiful way to gain knowledge. In the workplace, I feel the most common question is a why question. And the reason we do why questions should be fairly self-explanatory, because in a tech organizations, there's a lot of super analytical, in parentheses, critical people. And so they just like to ask the question why, as if they were a two-year-old toddler who did not get their way. And so that's the most prevalent question, because somebody, possibly in product management, is trying to get an engineer to do something they don't want to do. And so they ask why as a way to put up some resistance. So that question we hear a ton and can be useful, but can often be used in a not so constructive way. The other question that to me is the second most common is a what question. I don't see it as much, primarily because I think sometimes people might feel dumb if they ask a question like, what is an API? And so it's a little too dangerous for one's ego to ask something as simple as that, but it can happen. But the how questions, I feel, are the most rare of those three. Just because it just doesn't occur to us that we need to ask how. Just as a by way of quick example, like how many of us have asked ourselves, hey, how does the human voice work? Or how does my TV work? Or how does a remote control work? There's just so many things that we just kind of take for granted. It's like, I don't know, the voice works. Like, why do I need to care? But I feel like the better product managers, you know, those who have awareness, those who empathize with their customers, those who are looking for deeper insights, that's part of their black magic, that they get into the routine of asking how questions.
So when I was looking through that chapter, and I know it gets into some other things as well, I feel like one of the themes that I was pulling out of it was sort of boiling it down to this concept of theory of mind kind of sitting on both sides of the table of you as a person in product working with, and the example you just gave at the beginning of all this, of the what's that black magic to get somebody like the director of engineering to suddenly be on board with a an idea that they were resistant to in past conversations. And it's I think a lot of what you do within that chapter is framing different ways to get into that person's head so that you can understand what their priorities are, what they're trying to impact. And I think the flip side to it, which you explore pretty nicely as well here, is their understanding of what you know. And I think that that's exactly what you're getting at just here with the asking those what questions, where you might feel a little bit silly asking about or how something works, and getting to basically admitting that you may not know something to somebody who is assuming that you already do, and making sure that everybody's aligned and on the same page. And it's just getting to that understanding of that collective goal so that you can actually move things forward. And it seems to boil up from some of those earlier stage pieces of the framework, which of course start with execution right at the beginning. But it's some good stuff that you're covering in there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You talk a little bit in the book about System 1 and System 2 thinking, I imagine, and I'll throw the name out. Daniel Kahneman talks about it a bit in his book, and it seems like something that you find quite important to the operation as somebody in product. Can you tell me a little bit about how you apply, or let's start out with what are System 1 and System 2 thinking, and how do you think about applying them to the successful progression in a career as a person in product?
Yeah, boy, it's such a powerful concept. So you're absolutely right. So it was coined by Daniel Kahneman, legendary behavioral economist, won Nobel Prizes. And he wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, where he mentioned that the human brain, he postulated, has two modes of operating. One mode is system one, which is a very reactive mode. It almost feels like our fight or flight syndrome, where you don't really think. You just react to the situation, and you could feel yourself reacting maybe when you're opening up your email inbox and you're just like pounding through it and you're just thinking, react, 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 reply, reply, reply. And so it's very automatic. It's something that you might have done quite a bit in the past. And so it doesn't really require a lot of thoughtful thinking. System two thinking is not that reactionary thinking. It's a little bit slower and more pensive. And it's the type of thinking that you need when you're trying to brainstorm like a solution to a problem, or maybe brainstorming a problem itself. And so how does this manifest itself in kind of the day-to-day work? Gosh, in so many different ways. One way to think about it is, if you need to come up with or you need to brainstorm brand new ideas, you do need to take a step back where you do have some quiet time and you can't just brainstorm a brilliant ideas in milliseconds. You might need 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 3 hours quietly in a room to be able to explore ideas. And one of the things that might help facilitate that is maybe do that kind of thinking at the beginning of the day, where you might not have distractions, maybe like 7 a.m. in the morning before people start streaming into the office and start bombarding you with emails where you have to react to it. And another thing that you could use when you're thinking about system one versus system two is that the system one tasks that you react to are a lot easier to do because you've answered emails a million times before. You might have asked or answered questions about the product roadmap a million times before. And so because these tasks are easier to do, maybe you want to do them later in the day, like in the afternoon, where your energy, your willpower is running a little low. And so pounding through emails is something that's, doesn't feel as bad as something that's weighs a little bit more on your shoulders, such as brainstorming brand new solutions. And of course, doing it earlier in the day, you do also have the benefit of fresh coffee to get you all stimulated to really make sure you've got some impactful brainstorming sessions.
Yeah, hopefully we've all got access to fresh coffee throughout the day. But if not, yeah, certainly put those heavier tasks at the start where you've got that juice in your system. So definitely good thought there for bucketing in orientation to your coffee intake. So the system one thinking and system two thinking, there was an example in the book that stood out to me of looking at whether or not you're going to be using a solution that you've used before to answer the current problem. And certainly there are lots of cases where solutions you've used in the past are appropriate. But I like the way that it got framed in a not just leaning into here's what I'm used to doing, and so here is an answer to this challenge, and so this is what we're going to move forward and implement. And I think you gave the example of it was a mobile application versus a web application, and I forget which one was the established solution. But considering the various options before moving forward, as opposed to just doing the thing that has been done before. So it was partially an exploration of don't always do what's just easy in the way that you're used to seeing things and answering that question, when there might be other options available that would better tackle better tackle the challenge at hand. I wanted to ask you, because we've spent a fair amount of our chat so far on various ways that you can move up through the various steps in the product career path. What are some common roadblocks that you've seen that hold people back from moving from one step to the next?
Yeah, let's see. I would say, you know, most people are pretty darn good with the first step of the esteem method. So execution, getting things done. And the most common thing that I see is a lot of people get really frustrated that they can't seem to break into frontline management. And I feel one reason could be their communication skills, right? And so that's really that second step in the esteem method. And when it comes to communication skills, there could be a variety of different things going on where maybe the person, when they're trying to influence others, their thinking is not structured, or they don't know how to use storytelling, or they don't know how to use data effectively. And so good news, it's not catastrophic. And in the book, I mention several communication structures to help people be better organized and be more impactful with their communications, using things like the rule of three, which is a fancy way of saying every time you explain why you need something, like why do we want this feature or why are we going to focus on a particular persona, give three reasons. And that alone will make your answer a little bit more robust and full. Pros and cons is another great communication structure too, because not only does it force you to detail your thinking, but it also explores the cons as well. And I think a lot of people sometimes try to hide the cons of their proposal, thinking that it'll weaken their proposal, but actually has the opposite effect, because you don't share the cons. You've got your listener wondering what you're hiding, and naturally that hurts your proposal because they don't know what's lurking, and hence they don't want to support it. And so getting into that routine absolutely helps as well. But one of my favorite communication skills or frameworks is borrowed from the management consulting firm McKinsey, called situation complication resolution. It's a mouthful, but it is a very common way of or structuring your proposals, your ideas, in a way that people can accept it. And it usually starts off with a base of ground truth that's commonly accepted. We call that the situation. The complication is usually that twist in that situation. It also is in line with kind of storytelling dynamics, in the sense that every good story has a dilemma. In this case, we call it the complication, but a good dilemma that gets people on the edge of their seat, like dun dun dun, like what are we going to do next? And then, of course, no storyteller is going to be so irresponsible where they just leave you on the edge of dilemma and then, you know, walk away from you. Of course, you as a good storyteller will explain how that dilemma or that complication will be resolved. And then that's the last part, which is the resolution, or in the case of a product manager, it'd be their proposal or their solution that they're trying to get engineering or the executives to build. So I'd say communication is usually the number one reason that I see. There's a close cousin to it. Sometimes some PMs might be labeled as not being strategic enough. And in heart of hearts, when I hear that, I'm thinking to myself, it's probably because their communication skills are not strong enough. And whoever's giving that feedback that they're not strategic doesn't know how to verbalize that. And, it's really your communication skills. Because I feel like for a lot of managers, they feel bad about pointing out somebody's communication skills being a deficiency, especially if they're a native English speaker.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because I think often the solution for somebody who's being criticized as maybe not being strategic enough is the same solution as somebody who has that sort of buy-in and clout within the organization, but it's just a matter of explaining that solution within the context of the greater goals of the organization in a way where you are using probably one of these frameworks that you mentioned for communication to help everybody understand that we are all pointing the ship in the same direction and understand that this is the solution that's going to help us achieve getting to that destination. So it's being able to frame those solutions, even if you as a product manager have been in the weeds with your SQL queries and coming to a database understanding of where you want to go, being able to frame that in a way where you can build that buy-in with people from different departments, different stakeholders is significant. So yeah, I think communication being a big part of that, both on the something that can help accelerate your career growth, but also poor communication potentially being able to hold you back. Something that you highlight a fair amount throughout the book, and I think is something important and relevant to highlight here. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I often like to wrap things up by asking about some resources that have influenced you in the way that you've thought, maybe some things that have made their way in a little bit or another into the book. So I think, of course, the first resource that we'll just shout out there is, why don't you throw out the name of the book again and where everybody can find that if they want to pick themselves up a copy. But is there one or two other resources that you have found particularly instructive in your own thinking about product management, either now or in the past?
Yeah, so I'll take your invitation to give another shout out for the book. So the name of my new book is called Be the Greatest Product Manager Ever. And like all other books, you can find it on Amazon. So that's the best place to get it. Other books that I love when it comes to product management, Dan Olson does a great job in the Lean Product Playbook just to cover product management end to end. And so it's a favorite resource of mine. I absolutely use it as a reference. And so absolutely perfect for beginners, but even for practitioners, I think it's a good reference book to flip through from time to time. Other books that I like, you know, I'll have to admit I'm a big fan of emotional awareness. And so we talked about, you know, Daniel Kahneman's like Thinking Fast and Slow as being one of them. But just, you know, being aware of your emotional state. I wish I had some other books that I could think of at the moment, but you know, the whole understanding, you know, yourself, your emotions, how it can affect you and others is an absolutely important topic. And then the next thing that I'll mention, let's see, you know, we do talk quite a bit about grit, and Angela Duckworth in her book called Grit does a great job talking about the topic too. And so I think that would be the last book I'd recommend.
Yeah, I think all those great resources, and I'll make sure to give a link over to where people can find the book in Amazon in the show notes. So if you're looking to pick up a copy, you can look for that there. But Lewis, just wanted to thank you for walking us through how you think about moving through the ranks and being able to actually see that progression as somebody in the product space and through the various roles that somebody in product can target and explore and what they might be able to do to move from one stage to the next. And it's great that you're able to take all of that and put that down in a book that people will actually have as a reference, because I think there are so many books in product and resources that deal more with the specifics of I think that first step of execution. How do you involve yourselves in agile process, etc., and to be looking at a resource that focuses more on the career progression side of product is refreshing. So thank you for putting that together, and it's been great chatting with you today.
Yeah, you're welcome. I had a lot of fun. So thanks again for having me.
Thanks for listening to that conversation. The resources Lewis mentioned, including his new book, Be the Greatest Product Manager Ever, are listed in the show notes. If you are enjoying the show, you can help by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. To catch future episodes, make sure you're subscribed to the Why and the What Product Management Podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting service.